Let's turn to Matthew again, and we're going to look at part of the Sermon on the Mount at the very end, and then we're going to move on to two different sections of Matthew this morning. Yesterday, I suggested that one of the things that happens in the Sermon on the Mount is this change of architecture, and one of the things that I think expresses that is the verses that I mentioned again at in chapter 5, verses 13 and 14, or really 13 through 16, about salt and light. One of the things that's so interesting about those, the placement of those words in the sermon, it has to do with this sense that it's as though what Jesus is about to describe then is a holiness, a righteousness, a character of the people in the kingdom of God, one of whose principal markings is that our holiness is not for our sake only, it's for the sake of the world. So the point of being holy, the point of being righteous, in fact, the demonstration that we are holy and righteous, is that we actually are those things for the world. A great deal of Christian piety, especially perhaps in the last century, has been really focused on a kind of inward journey, and we're all aware that the church has been turning more and more outward, at least in its vocabulary. It has yet to necessarily show up in its language in the world, but the idea is that at least we're talking about being a missional church. We're meant to be a missional church. And the evidence of that is that by being people who are light and salt, we are pursuing a holiness, a righteousness that is not about a smug inner experience, but about an external reality that's demonstrated in the world that shows up as the holy, righteous character of God for the sake of others who need salt and who need light. So it's a very interesting inversion again of this theme. Now, one of the most sacred moments, I think, in the whole of the Gospel of Matthew, I think actually, one of the most dramatic moments in the Gospel of Matthew happens at the very end of 7 and the start of 8. If we understand that the Sermon on the Mount is this picture of this inverted righteousness, the righteousness that turns everything on its head, an inverted righteousness that blows out the walls, that ends up creating an affirmation of the central character of God, but redefines and intensifies and extends that righteousness to the world. And if it's an expression of a righteousness that's meant to be demonstrated, which is what the final parable is about the difference between the person who builds their house on rock and on sand, and then having said that the clear evidence of that is whether you actually do what has just been said, not just whether you affirm it or believe it or want it, but whether you actually do it. And then this summation of all this in 28, and when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, authority being one of Matthew's most important vocabulary words. Having said all that, then the very next thing that happens is this. And when Jesus had come down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, and there was a leper who came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you choose, you can make me clean." He stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I do choose, be made clean." Immediately his leprosy was cleansed. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." I hope that you understand now, at least in my reading of Matthew, why that moment is just astounding. At the moment that Jesus is, by this stage in Matthew's gospel, seen as the most remarkable expression of the authority of God that Israel has recently been experiencing by those who are able to hear and receive his teaching. And as the one who is giving the most exalted and amazing portrait of what righteousness really looks like, all words that would have meant anything but ever, ever, ever doing what he does as the very next act coming down from the mountain, is to actually go to the person and the place with the greatest possible stigma of the lack of holiness, of the unrighteousness, of the uncleanness. And it's to that person that Jesus, as the very first act off the mountain goes, as the most vivid demonstration of what he's just been preaching. So it's in that moment that he actually comes down to actually do what he said we should do at the end of the parable. You are only blessed, you are only building your house on rock if you do what I've just said. And the very next act coming down from the mountain is that he does what he had just been saying, and which no other rabbinic leader, no other righteous person of the day would have done. It's just the most dramatic moment. And he not only just encounters the one who's a leper. But he actually touches him and then sends him back to the very people who don't understand what he's doing and who are most likely to say, you are still unclean. You go back to them and you give them a testimony, as Jesus says, why? Go and show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded, again, back to this other architecture, that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. This is just, I don't know, we could just like sit in this for me, like the whole morning, we could just sit in silence before that text. Because it is such a dramatic, understated moment of just doing what Jesus had been saying needed to be done. Some of our most exalted moments as pastors are moments that I think by God's grace are appealing back of seeing the glory of God in ways in people's lives, especially I hope for you and for me in places of acute brokenness, of tragedy, of suffering, of pain. Those are some of the most amazing things about being a pastor. And in those moments, we have the chance of being able to actually, in some way, taste something of what it is that's actually going on in this verse. And in this expression, it's a story of that kind of profound righteousness that's enacted. But we could miss it. We could be so pristine that we are simply blind to the place where actually that light, that glory, that reality is most needed for them and for us. There's been a number of settings and many, many places in the life of my own experience as a pastor in Berkeley and in other places, and also in the travels that I've been able to do in other contexts. I had a chance a few years ago to go to northern India, where, as many of you will know, there's an indigenous explosion, really, of an indigenous Presbyterian denomination among untouchables, sometimes called the Witnessing Ministries for Christ or the Rural Presbyterian Church. Untouchables, as you probably all know, are not just at the bottom of the caste system, they're off the bottom of the caste system, they're below the caste system. So when a person who is untouchable is born, by Hindu law, they're supposed to be given only one name and one word name, which needs to be derogatory. So something like dung, ugly, stupid. These are the names, the common names that are given. One name and derogatory at that. The particular people that are part of the Rural Presbyterian Church on the whole are people who are latrine cleaners. So there's even within the untouchables, there is at least two and sometimes three tiers of untouchables. The bottom, the most bottom of the caste system of the untouchables is the latrine cleaners. There are some that are leather workers who are also people who are in the untouchable caste, but they are higher than the latrine cleaners. And the latrine cleaners are the caste or this group of people who are untouchable that are part of the Dalit movement that is the Rural Presbyterian Church. So they couldn't go any lower. And there is no way to actually adequately communicate the social stigma that is involved in this kind of birth experience. Philip Prasad, who lived for many years in Fresno, actually, and was a social worker, was somebody who was involved in this, and he was the person who actually went back as a Dalit himself and ended up realizing that he had done everything possible to escape his Dalit roots. He went back to his home village, and through a circumstance of an amazing kind, ended up really experiencing God's call to reclaim his identity as a Dalit, and to somehow see the birth of the church in these villages that he had been a part of and see the growth of the church unfold over the last 20 or 25 years. Philip is a very human person. He has great, 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 and amazing strengths. He has great weaknesses like any leader does. It's just all part of the story. But he has been an amazing person of identification with people who are Dalit. And one of the things that became so clear to him was that part of what had given him liberty himself was something that he had never really shared with other people until he returned to his homeland after having done everything possible to separate himself from it. And it was this, that Jesus had become a Dalit. And that the good news to Dalits was that Jesus was a Dalit. Now, how could a person ever make a claim that Jesus is a Dalit? Well, partly because of Matthew 8. Partly because of a moment like this moment in Matthew, in which it's so clear that Jesus is fully prepared to enter and identify with and touch those who are the untouchables. That is the good news. So those who had been excluded from any Hindu temple, any Muslim temple, any religious sacred setting in the normal practices of life in that setting in northern India are now invited, because the one who is their leader, the one who is their Lord, is the one who is among them as a Dalit. Now, we as Presbyterians have done a great deal by our commitment to educated ministry, by our commitment to the kind of integration of the gospel that we've done, to do anything but be Dalits. We have done everything possible to avoid being pastors who are Dalits. We don't want to be a Dalit. We don't want to be a social Dalit. We don't want to be an educational Dalit. We don't want to be a racial Dalit. We don't want to be Dalits at all. Nobody wants to be a Dalit. And nobody deserves to be a Dalit. But the cultural prison of Presbyterianism is a prison in which it's impossible in the structures and culture of our congregations in many cases to actually go to the places, to be with the people that Jesus, I think, would most instinctively and importantly want us to be with. And in doing so, we belie the gospel that we're actually meant to represent. At First Press, we're grateful that our church has become increasingly racially diverse and in some cases really dramatically so. But the greater prison for us is not that. It's really the prison of class. It's really the much greater challenge that we have, not to cross racial lines, but to cross class lines. We've become involved as a kind of adopted partner with some local schools in Berkeley and in Oakland. And part of the thing that we're aware of in these extremely needy schools, where sometimes as much as 90% in a couple of cases and 100% in another case, are all on subsidized school lunch programs, right? So a benchmark of tremendous economic poverty. And in that context, we go as tutors and as writing coaches and doing all kinds of things. There's wonderful relationships happening. There's great ministry occurring. There's real partnership. There's real self-offering. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. But we're realizing that one of the great handicaps we have is that while we can do that on an interpersonal level, it's very difficult to think of imagining inviting those people into the life of First Press. Because the very culture that we breed as a church immediately adjacent to the campus of the University of California is imprisoned in a class reality in which the ability to communicate to the majority of people that were there would simply be an irrelevance, if not an impertinence, to the people who we might want to invite from these other settings. So we're now engaged in trying to figure out, how are we really going to actually do this? And it's been, for me and I think for others on our staff and in our congregation, this really fascinating mirror that has now been held up to us to help us see our own bondage, to help us see our willingness to go to the mountain and to say amen to what Jesus is calling us to do, but then to find it institutionally, if not personally, institutionally and sometimes also personally awkward, to actually come down the mountain and to touch the leper, to actually engage with the person whose class reality, whose social, economic, political, religious circumstances may be so radically different than our own. So one of the great challenges of our churches and the dying that is so often talked about is a dying that we've really selected, because we've preached and taught people in a certain generation, and we've just continued to do that generation by generation without being sufficiently flexible. And then we've been unwilling often to break outside the boundaries of the architecture of our own structures and our own cultural and class realities in order to, and therefore fail to go to the places and the people who might actually be desperately hungry for a real and authentic evidence of the presence of God. But if we're going to do that, then we have to leave behind more, not less, than what we've actually also, on the other side of our lives, committed ourselves to doing everything possible to sustain. Now, this is just what we've been talking about over the last several days. This is not new. I'm not suggesting that I'm opening up a new can of worms. This is just the can of worms we've been like mired in over the last few days as we've been thinking about the challenges of what this alternative vision of the kingdom is really about. Part of what it means, I think, is that we have to commit ourselves to actually doing what we can to break out of the system. I can look in the faces of some of you, and I know your ministries well enough, to know that you've actually been significant leaders in your own local setting, actually figuring some of this out, just getting on with leading your congregations into settings that people wouldn't normally go to. I just want to say amen and thank you, thank you, thank you for doing that. Thank you for not being boxed in. Thank you for creating alternative patterns of life. Thank you for standing in session meetings and congregational meetings where that sort of vision may not be easily understood or readily accepted, where it might actually be something that has been really awkward for you or awkward for them. I just want to say thank you for that, Because the hope of our church is that we demonstrate the gospel, not that we just overcome issues of Amendment B or whatever version of that may be in our faces. We could win or lose that debate and lose entirely our mission in the world, because it's about something so much greater and so much more urgent, and frankly, fundamentally more in our faces, because it is such a common need to figure out how is the church, especially a church like our denomination, imprisoned largely in middle and upper middle class settings, in whether large, small, medium, whatever our congregations may be. That's the ethos of Presbyterianism. Just the other day, I was in a setting which is related to a service that I'm going to have to sadly perform tomorrow afternoon, the death of a preterm baby that just suddenly died in about 8 months in utero. The couple that are in that are facing this very, very serious tragedy for them are people that have never had anything to do with Presbyterianism. They've barely had anything to do with the church. They have remnants of Roman Catholic backgrounds from which they're deeply disgruntled and distanced. The husband, I think, would consider himself an atheist. The wife would consider herself a struggling agnostic, maybe, at best. But they want me, they want a religious person to be present at the burial of their baby. And so we've had some significant conversations about the meaning of this and why they would want that when in fact their own religious and spiritual views are so clouded. But one of the funniest moments in all of this was when they said, now, I was put in touch with them by a common friend. They said, now you're what we understand is called a, see, how do you say that? It's called a Presbyterian. How does that even spelled, they said. It was just one of those priceless moments. This, I said, I know, it's the denomination with the weirdest name. That's what I often think. And what it means is elder and what it has to do. And I go, really, really basically, it's just a form of Protestantism. And at the core, we're just a church that's trying to affirm that there is a God made known in Jesus Christ, who loves the world and has died for the world and risen for the sake of the world. And that's really what it means to be a Presbyterian. For now, that's all that it needs to be a Presbyterian.
Oh, if only.
If only, if only, if only. Oh, if only that it could be that that's what it meant to be a Presbyterian. But instead there's this crust, this unbelievable crust, some of which is about things that actually matter, and some of which is just really just crust. Now, Jesus, in the context of his own religious world, in which he's going to describe scribes and Pharisees as those who, again, are encrusted in the tradition. He'll say that in just a minute. In this encrusted tradition, Jesus is going to break that open again and again and again and simply insist, because it is the character of the God that he's serving, the love and justice of the God whose intentions include those beyond that crust. Jesus will continue to break that out. Now, just watch how this happens just in Matthew 8. I mean, again, through the whole of the early chapters of Matthew, we've seen the same stuff, but here it is again. So we've already seen this encounter with the leper. And now, it's not back to Israel, it's a continuation of that same theme. And when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, appealing to him and saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed in terrible distress. And he said to him, I will come and cure him. The centurion answered, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only speak the word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, again, that key word in Matthew, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. And when Jesus heard him, he was amazed and said to those who followed him, truly, I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and will eat with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the heirs of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And to the centurion, Jesus said, go, let it be done for you according to your faith. And the servant was healed in that hour. In this reading that I'm offering to you of the Gospel of Surprise, here again is this distillation for Matthew of so many of the key themes. The affirmation of the recognition of someone outside of Israel, that Jesus had to offer something which couldn't be found anywhere else. He wasn't changing his worldview. He wasn't changing his paradigm. He didn't claim to understand it, but he understood that Jesus had power and authority, and he was a man who understood power and authority. And he came to the one with power and authority and simply asked Jesus to exercise this, not on his behalf, but on the behalf of others. He explains why it is that he thinks this way. He's very much a kind of engineer, a military guy, somebody who understood exactly how the rules and principles actually played out. And then Jesus does this little sidebar. This amazing sidebar. I'm stunned by your faith. I'm stunned by your faith because it's even greater than many that whose faith I've heard about in the tribe of Israel. And what's even more than that, there will be some outside of Israel who will be welcomed into the household of faith, and there will be some who are the heirs of the kingdom who will actually find themselves in the outer darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth. Oh, and by the way, your servant is healed. It's just this. Again, do you see what Matthew's doing here? I mean, it's just this incredible distillation over and over and over again, this concentrated, intense, abrupt, smelling salts gospel. That's why it's so confrontational. Right there in the midst of it all, in a moment where you could have said, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Let's first get your theology straightened around. Let's first understand that you know who I am. Let's first be sure that you understand precisely what you're asking for, what you're going to get and what you're not going to get. Let me just receive that and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe anyone's really paying attention. But instead, he takes it at face value. He affirms it. He elevates it. He honors it. He provides for it in response to it tremendously. And then he also places it in this larger setting where he is exploding with dynamite the assumptions of what Israel is going to hold as its own private prerogative. Again, a confrontational, surprising gospel. When Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were possessed with demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and cured all who were sick. This was to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took our infirmities and bore our diseases. In that last verse, Matthew is clearly beginning to as he's been doing all along, but he reflects and makes explicit his own emerging theology of what it is that Jesus is actually doing. So he goes back and he refers to this very, very well-known text, and he begins to start explaining what ultimately becomes an understanding of Jesus as Messiah, who is the suffering servant. And the first moment of that, I think, in the Gospel of Matthew comes here in verse 17. This was to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took our infirmities and bore our diseases. In other words, it's not a phrase, very interesting, that could simply be a declaration of God's power. It's a declaration of identification. He says he took into himself our infirmities and bore our diseases. That's the proximity that he had to the suffering. And again, in an encrusted denomination, largely positioned in a class system, unquestioned and sometimes unrivaled and even defended implicitly by our own education and background, we end up becoming people who are simply have marginalized ourselves from the gospel and the God of the gospel who goes to the poor. We become the marginalized. This is part of what I think he means when he says those who are part of the inheritance will be put on the outside. We are marginalizing ourselves by being unwilling to actually identify with what is actually central to the heart of God. We put ourselves at a place of irrelevance rather than actually believing that the gospel is irrelevant. The gospel is endlessly relevant. It's the church positions itself as an irrelevance in the name of faithfulness. This is what Israel was doing. This is what the church in many quadrants of the world today, especially in the West, continues to do. And all of this, Jesus takes, I think, with the greatest seriousness. And again, we have to understand that if we're following Jesus, as the disciples were invited to do, then we are invited to actually go to the places that the Lord that we follow actually goes, to identify and to take into ourselves the same some measure of that same suffering, which is why I think Paul later talks about sharing in the fellowship of his sufferings in Philippians 3. Now, when Jesus saw great crowds around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. A scribe then approached him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of his disciples said to him, "Lord, let me go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." gosh. Do you see how relentless this is? This is absolutely relentless. I mean, we're still in chapter 8. We've just come down from the mountain. We have the leper. We have the centurion. We have the miracle at Peter's house with his mother-in-law. And now these would-be disciples saying, oh, but now I'm really there for you. And Jesus doesn't go, great, we'll count you in the Saturday night revival meeting count. You're in the inner ring. Instead, Jesus says, really? You're going to follow me? Well, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Really? You're going to follow me? You're going to follow me? As soon as you bury the dead, let the dead bury themselves. It's hard to imagine a more confrontational moment, culturally speaking, than that, right? This incredible moment of honoring the dead, of honoring those who've gone before you, all part of Jewish practice in the first century, this incredible sense of deference and appropriate respect and so forth. And even over that, Jesus scandalously, in this hyperbolic way, throws it back in their faces, think again. Now, is the gospel that we preach that serious? Are we actually that serious in calling, at the very least, ourselves into that sort of discipleship? And are we proclaiming that kind of serious gospel to at least the elders and the leaders of our congregation, let alone those who are the part of the wider community of our congregations themselves? Jesus is relentless about this. And it's relentless because what he's after is about, what, as we've talked about before, the demonstration of reality. This is not an exercise in religiosity. This isn't about religious formalism. This isn't about just finding a numbers game and trying to figure out how to get the most people in. This is really costly discipleship. This is, I think, what obviously caused Bonhoeffer to write The Cost of Discipleship. And it's why, he says, when Jesus bids a man come, he bids him come and die. Right. So do we? Or do we even come close to that? Accommodation is our language. It's not Jesus' language in Matthew. Not all of the Gospels are as abrupt as this. We have to, I think, rightly let it be contextualized in light of the whole story. We have to understand that there's much that we need to consider. I get all that. I'm like overeducated about that. I understand all that. But at the core, fundamentally, Jesus is just not interested in all that. What he's actually interested in is whether, in fact, we really get the core. And the only hope of the Presbyterian Church, the only reason the Presbyterian Church should even exist, is if we're committed to this, not if we're doing something else. It should die if we're not committed to this, not just as a central reality, but actually as the enacted, proclaimed, affirmed, sought, passionately longed for reality that we all need to grow into. I need to grow into. We need to grow into. Our churches need to grow into. But let's be clear, this is what it's about. It's not about something else. I remember one time talking to a friend of mine, an English friend of mine, who had spent a number of weeks in South Africa during apartheid days. I had been there myself. I'd spent some time in the same settings that he was in. He came back, and I was asking him about his experience and what he had learned during his time there. And he was describing some of the turmoil that was happening. It was sort of coming toward the time when Nelson Mandela was going to be released, but it was probably about a year and a half off from that. But the anger, the frustration, internal South African around the world was growing. So we were having this conversation, and after he had said a lot of things that I found very compelling, it felt like the conversation was just getting a little too intense. And I said, in this stupidly innocuous way, it's just all so complex. And he said, oh, it's not complex at all. No, apartheid is evil. What we need to do about apartheid is complex. But let it be clear, apartheid is evil. Now, I didn't have any confusion about whether apartheid itself was evil or not. But I was aware that in that little rhetorical moment, I was trying to create some space to breathe. I was trying to ease the intensity of the conversation. I was trying to step back from touching the leper. I was trying to figure out some way of not feeling the heat. And in doing that, not in any profound way in that moment, but in doing that, I was just giving in that small moment the indication that I really don't actually want the heart of God. That I'm not prepared to actually let the reality of evil and suffering in the world re-impinge on me. Now, I have to say that this has changed over the years. Very uncomfortably changed. And I would have to tell you that while I still feel like I have a great, great distance to go, I live every day giving deliberate attention, absorbing attention and time to people whose suffering is outside my own immediate congregation and world. I use icons on my computer, pictures that I've taken or that I've found of people whose circumstances remind me of the reality of a world that is in torment today. I'm going to get to wake up and be in a warm house with good food and a loving family, and I get to go and be the pastor of the church that I would most want to be the pastor of in the whole world. And I get to be with a staff that I love and who love me. And I get to be with a congregation of people who are eager and open and interesting and fascinating and bright and educated and creative. I get like the greatest thing going. But today, while I have the greatest thing going, 3 billion people are going to live in absolute poverty. And the big thing for them is going to be whether they can find water today. And whether there's any chance that that water is not going to be impure. Or whether they're going to be able to find enough firewood to be able to cook anything. Or whether they're actually going to finally be able to get any food. Like, that's going to be the day's work. There are millions upon millions of women who will spend all day today just doing nothing but walking to distant places and coming back with water carriers on their head, sometimes in multiple trips, just for the sake of that one need in their family. And that's every day. Or I think of the other icons that are on my computer. There are photographs of children, young children, who have been taken in human trafficking in some way, sex trafficking or other kinds of bonded slavery. And today I want to live with those faces in my life. They are part of my life, my world. They're meant to be part of my heart. They're meant to be the grist that actually fills my heart with what I hope is more and more the character of God. Not because I think I can fix that. I have no illusion about that. I'm not even meant to be the fix-it guy. But I am meant to share the heart of God. And I am meant to carry their heart and their circumstances and enact in response to them in whatever way I am capable of doing. And that's both people near and far away. And I want to spend time every day letting those realities become my reality so that I don't wake up in the illusion that thinks, gosh, I have the greatest family and the greatest job and the greatest church and the greatest circumstances, as though that's the story of what matters in the world or most of all to God. When what really matters is, what's all that for? It's for the sake, in part, of acknowledging that all of it is for the work of what God is doing in my life in response to the world for which Christ has died. And if all this doesn't somehow respond to all that, then all this doesn't have any meaning. And could actually be, as Jesus himself said, the very illusion that causes those in the household of faith to lose their inheritance, not to gain it. Now, this is complicated stuff to work out. You can become paralyzed. You can become overwhelmed. You become catatonic. You can actually feel sad a lot. You can wake up tearful over the things that you can't do anything about, or over the people and circumstances that you know are suffering today. Yeah. And none of that is wrong. That's actually all part of the struggle. That's all part of what it means to actually be a disciple in the world. And if it doesn't mean that pretty often, then we really have to ask ourselves, what are we doing? Of course it matters in relationship to people immediately in our congregations. Of course it matters to people immediately down the street or around the corner or in our neighborhood. That all matters. And it also matters in relationship to this wider picture of the world. Matthew, I think, gives us a picture of Jesus in this way that is just mind-blowing and disorienting and makes everyone around him uneasy. Do you want to follow me, he says? Well, then let the dead go bury their own dead. When he got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and a windstorm arose on the sea, so great that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. And they went and woke him up, saying, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid of little faith? Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was dead calm. And they were amazed, saying, "What sort of man is this, that the winds and the seas obey him?" And when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demoniacs coming out of the tombs met him. They were so fierce that no one could pass that way. Suddenly they shouted, "What have you to do with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now a large herd of swine was feeding at some distance from them. The demons begged him, "If you cast us out, send us into the herd of swine." And he said to them, "Go." And they came out and entered the swine, and suddenly the whole herd rushed down the steep bank, ruining the commodities market, into the sea, and perished in the water. The swineherds ran off, and on going into the town, they told the whole story about what had happened to the demoniacs. And then the whole town came to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their neighborhood. And after getting into a boat, they crossed the sea and came to his own town. Again, if we had longer, both the stilling of the storm, which I think is, in, among other things, simply a declaration of his authority over every aspect of the natural order, as well as over every aspect of human and moral and social need, then actually confronts the demoniacs, who, again, in the understanding of the first century, are both perhaps filled with demons, but also people who are psychologically ill, probably or perhaps both. It's often unclear even today which is which. Jesus doesn't need to sort all that out. He just acknowledges the reality of the demons, casts them into the pigs. They go over the edge of the water, and then he just goes on with his day. They begged him to leave their neighborhood. I think it would be a sign, perhaps, of the authenticity of the gospel in Berkeley that our church was begged to leave the neighborhood. So present was Jesus Christ in our church that we just longed for the neighborhood to be cleared of those people because they're so like Jesus. I'm not like that. I'm too affable. I'm not like that. I'm sometimes still too dependent on seeking other people's approval. I'm not like that. I have too many radar that tell me what's socially acceptable and what's not, and when people feel awkward, I feel it in my body. And yet, if I'm a disciple of Jesus, that awkwardness is meant to not only be acknowledged, but embraced, and actually followed, and extended. And part of what we are called to is this really awkward, salty life, this awkward, salty gospel. And yet, again, the tendency of the culture of Presbyterianism, informal or formal, high church, low church, small church, big church, is still stuck in a kind of formality that doesn't understand, or a structure in any case, that doesn't allow this kind of confrontational gospel to actually be our gospel. We have, I think, domesticated God in ways that has enormous price for the world. And what happens if its salt loses its saltiness? It is of no value. I think that there are evidences in our church, and I'm sure in your churches, of the light, this kind of light, this kind of salt breaking through. But are we fanning it? Are we encouraging it? Are we trying too much to manage it? Are we trying to discipline it? Does it always need to be under our control? Or are we prepared to actually take a much riskier step, which is to allow this kind of gospel, this sort of saltiness, to actually be unleashed in a way that cannot be managed, that is really awkward, to actually find its root in our own hearts and minds? There are people in my life who are witnesses to this, who just are these people that do salty things, and they have helped me learn to do saltier things than I would otherwise do. I have a long list of them. I want to tell you today about just one of them. His name is Gary Haugen, who's the founder of International Justice Mission. Gary and I met each other a number of years ago and discovered that we had all kinds of overlapping worlds of people that we each had known and known about, and we'd known about each other, but we had never met. And I met him literally on the Sunday that he preached at First Press for the first time. We went out for lunch afterwards, discovered all these things that we had in common that were part of our backgrounds, but we had many things that were not in common. And part of it was just circumstantial. Part of it had to do with the world that he had been in. Some of you know that Gary had been sent by the United Nations to be the head of the UN investigation into the Rwandan genocide. And he arrived in Rwanda just a week or two after the genocide seemed to have come to an end. And so he spends the next 6 months just doing this investigation, literally going into all of the stadiums and the churches and the highways and byways where there were nothing but stacks of bodies. They were literally involved every day in just doing body counts. They were trying to figure out how a certain kind of killing had occurred in certain places. They were trying to map it so they had a clear sense of what the evidence was. They began to take verbal depositions from various people who had been involved and witnesses to all this. So for 6 months, you're doing nothing but literally smelling and living in the stench of some of the most tragic human depravity that we've seen in recent years. And Gary came back from this, changed. He had lived in South Africa during apartheid days. He'd had other experiences in other places. He was ready to do something more than simply work for the Justice Department. And he decided that what he needed to do was to give fresh ear to the suffering of people in places where without any defender, without an advocate, people suffer and have no hope. And this is what ultimately led to the founding of IJM. Now, as Gary and I were getting to know each other, eventually after we'd spent a number of times together, I said, "Now, Gary, I know I've heard the story about the whole Rwandan thing and the genocide. I get that. I get that you did this incredible thing. It makes sense to me that you could do this. But I just have to tell you that I think if I had done the Rwandan genocide thing, I think I would still be in the mental hospital. I really think that I would just be so paralyzed by what that experience would have been, psychologically and emotionally, that I'm just really not sure that I would do anything about it." And Gary said, "Well, but that wouldn't be of any help." I said, "Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean that I wouldn't still be in the mental hospital. I mean, I would still find myself just, yeah, but that would then," he went on to say in a very gentle way, "but that would actually make your suffering the real issue, when it's not actually about your suffering. It's about their suffering that's the issue. Is it terrifying to me," he said, "to actually have witnessed all that I've witnessed? Totally. Is it disruptive to my psychological well-being? Oh, yeah. Does it make certain days really hard? Does it raise theological and spiritual questions that are really difficult? Oh, yeah, all that. Oh, yeah, totally." And it turns out, he said, "Now I understand why I need the gospel. Because I'm so exposed to the reality of need that I get why the gospel is our only hope. And now what I'm meant to do is actually do something about someone else's suffering, not to create a world or live in a world which is really mostly about mine." "Okay, Gary," I said, that makes sense, but it's not easily my instincts. I've realized, and I've tried to do everything as a matter of spiritual discipline to try to break open my own heart to respond more deeply and more profoundly. I love people that love me. I don't really love people that don't love me. I've had to learn that. We talked about enemy love. Here, I think we're talking about people who are perceived to be enemies of someone, or who are the enemied. That is, those who have been made the scapegoats, those who have been often at the end of the abuse of power. Part of what we have to face is that reality. I remember one time I was reading a Palm Sunday book to my youngest son, Sam, when he was about 4. He was sitting in my lap, and it had a picture of Jesus riding on a donkey. He was looking at that. We had this sweet picture. He kind of was tracing the picture with his hand. He said, "You know, Daddy, Jesus lives in my heart." I said, "Sam, that's so wonderful that Jesus is in your heart." And then he said, but what about the donkey?" I said, "Trust me, Sam, the ass is at hand." I mean, that's the problem, that the ass is there with Jesus in my heart. And part of what has to be worked through in all this is that there's just an ass right alongside Jesus. And I want the ass more than I want Jesus. And part of the difficulty here is that I've got to deal with the ass, the donkey of my own stubbornness, my own self-interest, my own self-preoccupation, my own unrelenting desire for things to be my way. And what's happening here in Matthew is Jesus is just exploding that everywhere. The religious authorities, disciples, people that are outside Israel, people that are inside Israel, nobody's safe. That's why it's the smelling salts gospel. Lord, by your grace, we don't have easy resolution to this. There's no easy way of tying up these themes. There's no logical, systematic, controlled pattern of how we live in a way that's not vulnerable and exposed. Of course, the sin we have to confess is that we try to do just that. So we create structures and patterns of life that do everything to distort our perception and to cause us to fail to see and then to name and then to act in ways that are faithful to you. Lord, speak again to us. Do we need to let the dead bury their own dead? Do we acknowledge that there is something truly arresting and disorienting about how big your gospel is and how much it's meant to redefine reality? Lord, deliver us from the kind of domestication that we are guilty of, from letting the donkey's voice be more powerful than yours. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.